which is the issue surrounding 37, Paper Series 2. And Patrick, I think you have that.
Hello, everybody. The committee received a request to clarify whether IFIC 6 should be applied by analogy to other levies charged for participation in a market on a specified date to identify the event that gives rise to a liability. During the last meeting, the committee discussed whether the obligating event is the participation in a market on a specified date or whether other factors create an earlier obligation. The committee decided to add this issue to its agenda. The committee also tentatively concluded that IFIC 6 is not directly applicable, but because IFIC 6 is an interpretation of IS 37, any conclusions drawn on the application of IS 37 to the levies should be consistent with the conclusions drawn in IFIC 6. For ease of reference, we have split the analysis in three papers. Paper 2A discusses when the liability should be recognized. Paper 2B discusses whether the liability is associated with an asset or an expense. And paper 2C provides some examples. The papers do not address the accounting treatment applicable in the interim financial statements. The committee will consider later whether this second issue should be added to the agenda. As a starting point, we think that an analysis of the rights and obligations associated with the payment of the levy should be performed. We note that the levy is intended to be a recurring annual tax that, in substance, is charged in return for the entity participating in a market for a specified period. We think that the obligation to pay a levy in the cases described in the papers is associated with a right for the entity to participate in a specific market for a specified period. So the first question for the committee is the following. Does the committee agree that the obligation to pay a levy is associated with a right for the entity to participate in a specific market for a specified period?
So as I understand it, Patrick, what you're doing is saying that this is perhaps analogous to a license fee or a toll or something like that rather than a pure tax.
More like a fee rather than a tax.
Okay, I've got some lights blinking, but unfortunately I can't see the red things. So Ruth, I'm going to start with you.
Okay, thank you. In respect of that specific question, is the levy associated with a right to participate? I think the answer is it might be, but my concern is that I'm not sure that it creates an asset because, for example, with the banking levy, I would have thought that the right to participate in the market is a banking license, which is something completely different, which may or may not be recognised as an intangible asset. So I'm not sure there's a direct link between the payment of the levy and the creation of an asset. There may be, but I'm not sure there is in all cases. And in addition to that, even if there is some sort of right, I'm not convinced that it meets the definition of an asset because I don't understand how there is control over future economic benefits, how the entity controls those benefits, which I think you try to address later in the paper. But that's my main concern with your later argument about an executory contract and the asset and so on, is I struggle to see how the entity controls the future economic benefits and therefore how we can recognize an asset.
Andrew?
Well, I was going to make a very similar comment to Ruth, so I think the answer to your question is it might be, but that is a very fundamental assumption that underlies the rest of the analysis. I mean, some of these levies, you already, for example, the banking one, you already are participating in the market. You have to incur lots of additional regulatory type costs to participate in the market. It's not this levy alone that secures access to the market. And, you know, you could argue in substance that it's not really in exchange for a right to participate in the market. It's a punitive type tax. And whilst I know we're all trying to get to a common sense answer on this, I think just leaping to that assumption without benchmarking it against other situations or kicking the tires a bit more is potentially dangerous. Because if I pay this levy, I know that's paper 2B, the asset side. I'm not sure what else I'm securing. I don't think I'm already in the market. I've got to incur a lot of other costs to participate in that market. I'm not getting any additional benefits as a result. So simple answer to your question is it might be, but I think a little bit more work, a little bit more analysis in terms of benchmarking other situations would be appropriate before we just make that as a sweeping statement.
Do you have a particular situation in mind that you think would work the other way?
Benchmarking
against what? Do you have something in mind?
Well, I mean, in order to be a bank, you have to have a compliance officer, you know, his salary. In order to be a bank, you have to file regulatory returns. You have to do a whole lot of other things.
I see.
You have to pay for a banking license, as Ruth said. So I'm sympathetic, don't get me wrong, I'm sympathetic to the argument because it kind of drives you in the right direction in terms of a common sense answer, but I don't think we should just leap there.
I think Laurence and Charlotte, you were both on at one point there.
I was trying to have a holistic view about the package with all your papers before responding only to your question in agenda paper 2. I think I like the directions where you are going. And particularly for my environment in France, I could see how it would apply to the taxes that we have been discussing. So I think that for some taxes it might work well. For the treatment of some of the taxes, it might work well. But I must admit that when I read Agenda Paper 2C and run into the banking levy, I think it's the case 2 or so on, the logic that you develop was not working as well as in other cases. So maybe in the same case as the other, so yes, it might. I may agree with your point of view. The second point I would say is perhaps also if we move ahead, we would need to specify what does it mean, what is a tax levy charged for participation on the market in a specified date, to make sure that people understand what scope of taxes we are talking about. I think it is important.
Charlotte? You need to push your button there.
I think I agree with a lot of people say. I don't actually think the paper scopes in the bank levy. The circumstances it describes are not those of the bank levy, so it would still leave the question of, well, that's all very nice to know, but how do we treat the bank levy, which isn't linked to a right to operate in a market for any specific period. It's not really linked to a period. It definitely doesn't give you the right to do something going forward. I think it is conceptually more of a tax or a fine. So I think some of the points later on about it restricting ability of others to enter the market just aren't true. There aren't a certain number of people who have to pay the levy, and that paying it means that other people can't in. And the other costs of entering the banking market probably outweigh it. And to be fair, the costs are really the cost of exiting the market would be bigger than the cost of entering it. So I just don't think it answers the question. And I don't know whether we were specifically trying to do more general questions and we were trying to avoid answering the bank levy question, which I don't think is the right approach if we're going for the approach of helping people who've asked the question. So I think you need to really go back and look at the situation of the bank levy. What are the circumstances that we need to consider for that, where the right the asset side isn't clear at all?
I think at one point or another I had Scott, Joanna, and Bernd with lights on. Scott?
In trying to answer the question of whether there's a license or some form of intangible asset, I found that somewhat difficult to think about, as did others. On the other hand, the alternatives to thinking about it that way as some sort of tax or a levy or just a period cost of doing business, I still come back to the fact that I would want the cost to be spread across whatever period this relates to. I think it would be a poor answer if we wound up saying, you know, whatever the date is on which we think there's a liability, record the whole liability on that day and book the entire expense that day. That doesn't seem to reflect what's going on here. Whether you think there's an asset or not, I'm not sure, but it certainly feels to me like it is a cost that should be recognized over the period in which you operate and therefore are required to pay. So I think depending upon when we believe the liability is incurred, do we believe the liability needs to be recorded all on a particular day or even ahead of that period, I think that may lead us to booking it as an asset, whether that asset is a license, a prepaid service fee, or something else. It just seems to me that if we answer the asset question first, we can back ourselves into a corner where, you know, January 1st, 2013, everybody books a slew of expenses on that day, which doesn't seem appropriate.
Joanna?
I think probably where I've got to on this, and particularly listening to the articulation of the concerns, which I did too, is that we are trying to put all of these levies, charges, into one basket and saying they are all the same thing. And therefore, we are trying to find a holistic, homogenous solution for all of them. But I think that what we have actually demonstrated is that they are actually different levies, different charges for different reasons. And therefore, for us to try to put them all into one box and say this is how we should account for them, I think is perhaps on dangerous and slippery ground. And that may be that we, although we tried to say, can we deal with them all together? To start with, maybe the answer is that we can't. And when you get to your 2A paper, which is levies charged for participation in a market, yes, if it is levies charged for participation in a market and you've reached that original conclusion, then maybe what you've got in 2A is right, but you cannot conclude that every levy meets that and that each one needs to be considered on its own. And I haven't thought it through enough to say where do you start with each one, but like everything else, every other expense or charge that we have, that we consider how to account for, we use judgment. And I would argue that, well, that's actually probably what we should be doing, or we should not be putting them all into one basket.
Okay, I have Bernd, Guido, and Margaret in that order.
Is it working?
Yes.
Well, first, same comments as especially Ruth and Andrew made. I'm especially struggling with the idea that we have an asset in many cases, because that would mean that with the levy we buy something with the right. And as Ruth said, the banking license is usually not bought by paying the levy, but you have the banking license and it's independent from that. So as others said as well, I don't think that we necessarily have an asset. Furthermore, I agree with what Joanna said. Maybe we cannot put all the levies into one basket. And to broaden on that argument, we were talking about annual recurring tax here, but maybe we should also have in mind some other levies that are not paid annually, but one-offs, one-time levies or fines, so to speak, which are not paid regularly, not on an annual basis, but if something happens that the company did in the last year, not annually, but only on certain grounds. So maybe we should scope that in as well.
We don't. You can push the button, then I know who to turn on here. Okay. Dynamite.
I have to say I was not that much concerned about the question, but that is an asset, whether we have an asset or not. I understand that the staff went this route because they want to get maybe to an answer, which makes a lot of sense, as Scott said, to come to kind of a matching principle. When you get the revenues, you should also recognize the expenses. Now, the problem is that we don't have a matching principle under IFRS, so we have to look at the liability side, IAS 37. And 37 tells you need to have a past event. And my understanding is that in looking at these levies as an executory contract, you were trying to define those performance obligations as the past events. So as soon as the government has performed its obligation, I have a liability to pay. So I think that's a good idea. The question really is, do we come to the right answers with that? But at the end of the day, I think it's not about whether we have an asset or not. You may have an asset that is consumed in the same minute. We know that was the reasoning behind IFRS 2. You have an asset and it's consumed, so it's expensive. So I would not worry about whether we have an asset or an expense. The question is there a performance obligation by the government? And has the government performed? And do I have a liability to pay them at that point of time? And is it over a period or is it at a certain point of time? So I think the idea is worth following. I don't think that we should concentrate on whether we have an asset or not. It's about the performance obligation. And if this is the past event and we have a past event, then that's fine. Now, the other thing, though, we have to think about, and that's also in the paper, is there a realistic alternative of settling this liability? So those two criteria, I think we need to look at.
What did you mean by a realistic alternative of settling? You mean transferring it to somebody else, or
any kind of? If you go out of the market, let's say in the examples we always are looking at the year 2011. If you would go out in 2012 and would not have to pay for it, then there would be a realistic alternative. Some people say it's not realistic, but that's another issue that's addressed in the paper.
You mean
avoiding to pay it, right? I mean that's what paragraph 17 and 37 says.
Okay, I think I have Margaret and then Ruth.
I agree with Scott that I think there's some kind of an asset that exists as a result of making this payment. I'm not sure what you would call it, but if you were to acquire a company that had just made this payment, I would think that in purchase accounting you would have to set up something for that item that you would be amortizing over a certain period of time. So I'm not sure, you know, what you would call it, but I think I agree that there is an asset that's formed.
Ruth?
Yeah, just to Guido's point, I think, as I said before, I don't think there is an asset in this particular example. But I think the issue is to focus on, and I think you try to get to it in 2C with your examples, is do I have to recognise the liability at a point in time, or can I recognise it over a period? And I think in one of your examples you conclude that the liability is recognised over the period, it's accrued over the period. And in the other example you say it must be recognised on the 1st of January, and I wasn't clear as to why you had concluded that. And I think if we could explore that a bit further, we might get to a solution without trying to find an asset, because I'm very uncomfortable with saying there's an asset there. I think even in purchase accounting, you might account for the banking license, but you wouldn't account for the fact that you have to pay a fee as an asset. So I'm more interested in pursuing the line of thinking of, does my obligation arise on day one that I participate in the market, in your example, the 1st of January 2011, or does it arise progressively over the period that I participate, which would allow me to accrue the liability progressively? And then I think we can avoid the asset problem. So I would rather go down that path if we're trying to solve this, if it's feasible.
Ruth just said what I was about to. I wonder if we can divorce the asset question and focus only on what the obligating event is, whether that would be a useful approach. We'll have to come back around to the question of are there circumstances in which I create an asset? But I'm not sure that I have to answer both of them at the same time. I think it'd be more efficient if we took them separately. Scott?
I think that might be helpful in terms of our discussion, but as Wayne said, I think we do have to answer the asset question because sometimes the fee is payable on January 1st, 2011. Once you're in the market at the beginning of the year, you have 30 days to pay the fee. So then we pay the fee early in 2011, and it's no longer a question of accruing a liability. We've already paid. So now it's a question of whether there's an asset to be recorded. And Guido looked at it from the perspective of government performance. I hadn't really thought of the government performing, but it seems to me if one believes that the government is performing something in respect of this payment, then you could say the government performs over the course of a year, and therefore if you pay early in the year, why then you have a right to future service for the rest of the year. So it's not a classic intangible, it's a prepaid.
Okay, and then we'll get to Charlotte and Laurence.
Yeah. I was just going to say, on Scott's point and Guido's about the government performing, I think the other side of that is the entity receiving. So that was the perspective, obviously, that we were trying to go down within the papers. But I think it's two sides of the same coin.
Why don't we let you know this? There we go.
It's me? Yeah. Very quick, but you know, this is really very interesting question because you brought in the finance lease example, and people are still trying to find out what comes first, what drives the asset and what drives the liability. You could say for a finance lease, and also in this circumstance, yes, I have a right to use the asset, so I have an asset. Debit asset, credit what? Oh, there has to be a liability. You could also argue, no, I don't have a liability right now because I haven't used that asset over the term of a year where I have to pay the lease. So what is driving what? I don't think that we should go into this discussion here. So I would also say that we should concentrate on the obligating event, on the liability, and then the debit side might be expense, it might be an asset. But I think that was not the question that was asked to the committee. The question was asked, do we have to recognize an obligation or liability?
Okay, I have Charlotte, Laurence, Andrew, and Joanna.
I think we should divorce the asset and the liability question. On the liability side, I think the bits that need exploring are the no realistic alternative and what do we mean by that, because that seems to come up differently in different places in the paper. And also the interaction with that, with the creating a reasonable expectation, which at times in some of the examples of IS 37 seems to be the deciding factor in creating an obligation, but other times seems to be ignored. So I'm not sure how those two bits interact and which one would outrank the other.
Right.
Just to remind that the taxes are where the tax is due if you are in operations on 1st of January, but the amount is calculated based on that of previous periods is very prevalent. And so I know that in my jurisdiction, the analysis that has been made for years was to provide for it as of 31st December of the previous year, so that on 1st of January you already had your provision for it, and you just pay. I know that in my jurisdictions as well, there was a working group with the standard setter that has been looking again at this issue, asking exactly the same questions that we were having, looking at whether the government was performing or not performing, and it is a difficult question to answer here when you pay this variety of taxes. do believe that it is a real difficult issue. And again, I'm not sure we can really divorce the questions about do we only have a liability without looking at how do you treat the debit, so as to have an answer, making sure that we have an answer that makes sense.
Andrew?
Well, happy to look at the obligating event sort of, and when that occurs, but to Guido's point and the concept of government performance, I think if we go down that route, we need to answer the question, is the government performing because you paid that levy, or was it performing anyway? You were already in the market, and hey-ho, here's a bit, we'll have a bit more cash for you participating in the market. So, you know, does that extra payment secure a performance obligation on behalf of the government that it was already performing? I don't know the answer to that, but I think that's worth looking at.
Joanna?
The obligating event. I think it really has to be looking at the obligating event. I do acknowledge, though, that then the debit side of it and how you deal with the debit has to be considered after that. But it's first of all, when do I have a liability? And arguably, that should actually be relatively straightforward in terms of we've got 37 that says, you know, when you have an obligating event and I've got a liability. But I actually think, despite the fact that that was the question that was asked, the issue is, how do you treat the debit? And in some ways, it's interesting in that a lot of this discussion in some ways is similar to discussion that has been held in the not-for-profit sector and the public sector about non-exchange transactions, as to whether or not you can, should, spread, and do you have performance obligations. Now, we've talked about government's performance obligations, but it's actually you know, non-exchange revenue, if you like, on the other side, and saying, well, when do you... So I would encourage you perhaps just to have a look at some of the discussions that have been going on in the public sector field around this non-exchange, because arguably you're paying, as Ruth said, it could be a one-off levy, or someone said, you know, a one-off levy or a one-off something, or just levies, which are taxes, which are arguably a non-exchange. You know, that's what we've said. If there is no asset, it's arguably someone's just said, well, like I've been reading in the papers here, someone, you know, you've now got to pay 50 cents in the 50p in the pound for your income tax if you own over 150,000. Arguably, that is just simply a levy, a fine, a, you know, how do you deal with it? There is no exchange in relation to that. So just thinking through those logics of when, and it's not when the credit, the liability is recognised, it's what you do with the debit. And is it just a straightforward prepayment, or is it expense on day one, or actually, in some instances, it may be an intangible asset. And I think that that may be the way to actually approach it.
Patrick, where do we stand?
Because the committee members expressed their concerns on the executory notion and the asset side, maybe we should focus on the definition of the present obligation that is in the paper 2A. So if we move on to the definition of a present obligation, we note that some of the concerns expressed in the original submission are about the accounting treatment applicable to levies for which the calculation period precedes the activity period. The question is whether the obligating event is the participation in the market or whether other factors create an earlier obligation. In the example described in paragraph 46 of paper 2A, the levy is due if entity C generates revenues in the market in 2011, and the amount of the levy is determined by reference to revenues generated in the market in 2010. The entity does not have a legal obligation at year-end 2010 to participate in the market in 2011. Thus, the question is whether a constructive obligation exists at year-end 2010. Some argue that a constructive obligation exists at year-end 2010 because at that date, it would be necessary for an entity to make some unrealistic action in order to avoid the obligation. As said before, we think that the levies described in the papers represent operating costs of a specified period that need to be incurred to operate in that period. IS 37 states that no provision is recognized for costs that need to be incurred to operate in the future. As a consequence, we think that in the example described in paragraph 46, no provision is recognized at year-end 2010 because the levy represents operating costs that need to be incurred to operate in 2011, that is to say a future period. Moreover, according to IS 37, provision can be recognized only in respect of an obligation that arises independently of the entity's future actions. We note that the fact that it is economically unrealistic for the entity to avoid the expenditure does not create a constructive obligation and does not cause the recognition of the liability in IS 37 and in the illustrative examples of IS 37. Thus, we think that the obligating event in accordance with IS 37 is the participation in the market identified by the legislation. We observe that IFRIC 6 also addresses the issue of the date of recognition of the WIL liability in the case where the calculation period precedes the activity period as for the levies described here. And it is consistent with the rationale that I just presented. In particular, IFRIC 6 concludes that participation in the market is the obligating event in accordance with IS 37, and that a stated intention to participate in a market during a future period does not create a constructive obligation. So the questions to the committee are the following. Does the committee agree that the obligating event is the participation in the market identified by the legislation? And does the committee agree that the rationale in IFRIC 6 is consistent with the analysis described in the paper?
Scott, you had your light on at one point there.
Well, I thought better of it, but I'll talk anyways. Never stopped me in the past.
Thank you for saying
that. What's bothering me about the example and the way this gets applied is I think the example is actually a situation in which there are two obligating events: participation in the market in 2010 and in 2011. Because if you didn't participate in 2010, your participation in 2011 does not raise an obligation to make a payment. Or perhaps one could argue it raises an obligation to make a payment, but the amount of that payment is zero. But let's not quibble with that. It seems to me that the example is a situation where you must do two things in order to have to make a payment. And the analysis would seem to me to lead to a situation where if you have a contractual or legal situation where you only have to pay if you do multiple things, then we never record a liability until you've done all of them. And I started trying to apply that logic in other situations, and I didn't much care for the results. If you're a company that has a product where every time you sell you have to pay a royalty, can have these situations where you perhaps pay an ongoing royalty for each sale, and then if you hit certain sales targets, there's a large lump sum additional royalty. So if the contract says that once you reach 100 million euro in sales, you have to make a special one-time 10 million euro royalty payment, does that mean that only when you get to the sale that gets to 100 million, that's the first time you book anything of that 10 million euro bonus liability, royalty? I didn't much like the answers that I was getting to if I accepted this logic in this situation. This really seems to me like the real question that we need to answer is, when there are multiple obligating events, do we record a liability if we have, if some of those events have occurred but others have not yet? And if we stick with, if it's dependent upon the future, we never record the liability, I don't think we're getting the answers that were intended.
Okay, I've got Ruth and then Andrew. And Bernd.
In respect of this specific example, if the facts are that the terms of the arrangement are that you pay the levy if you participate in the market on a certain date or over a certain period, then I agree with your conclusion that that is the obligating event. It's either on the date or over a period. I think the complicating factor is, I think as Scott has alluded to, is that the amount of the levy is calculated by reference to revenues. And there are two different revenues. One is the amount that I pay in the next year, in 2012 in your example, and that's calculated based on 2010 revenues, which arguably has got nothing to do with what I did in 2011. It's just a basis for calculation. So that's the one piece where the revenues is relevant, and I think that's relevant only to the calculation of the amount that I have to accrue. The second thing is the participation obligation may or may not be related to the revenues earned in 2011. So that's the second piece of the puzzle. And that's, I think, where we get to the question of, do I record the liability in full on the 1st of January because that's the date at which I start to participate, or do I record it ratably or evenly over the period or in some other way because it is calculated as I earn revenues, even though those revenues that I earn actually have nothing to do with the calculation because I'm calculating based on 2010. And to me, that's where we get a bit mixed up between recognition and measurement. And I think in example one in your later paper, there's a bit of a mix-up between recognition and measurement. I think the recognition has got nothing to do with the revenues, nothing to do with the revenues of 2010 for sure. It might have something to do with the revenues of 2011 in terms of when I recognise, but not the amount at which I recognise. And that's what I thought we could explore a bit further is, do I have to recognise the obligation in full on day one, credit, liability, debit, expense on the 1st of January, or is there any argument to say that because my participation is determined by reference to revenues, I have some way of recognising it, accruing it over the period instead of in one block? Now, to me, strictly speaking, under the framework, if I've got an obligation on day one, I've got a liability on day one. And I know that's not the answer everybody's looking for, but if that's when I have the obligation, that's when I have the obligation. If there's some way we can find a way to accrue it, I'd be open to that. But we've got to stay true to IAS 37. So I agree with your conclusion that the obligating event is the participation in the market, and I agree with your conclusion that you shouldn't be accruing for a future event. So in answer to your question in paragraph 65, I agree with your recommendation.
Andrew?
Similar comment, really. I think we do need to think about, when we're analysing this subject, think about recognition and measurement very carefully. I mean, the kind of situation that Scott mentioned in his example is a bit like the volume rebate situation, and I think where you tend to, if there's a volume rebate once you hit a trigger amount of supplies, then you tend to anticipate whether you will hit that trigger in measuring transactions. For example, if you're a purchaser, then you're buying things, and what you're trying to estimate is the best cost of what you're buying. So you would anticipate ultimately getting a volume rebate, which affects the cost of what you bought. Equally, if you're a seller, you're trying to estimate the amount of revenue you've got, and if you've got to give something back ultimately in respect of the thing you've already sold, then that's, you know, I think you take that into account in measuring what you sold already, even though you haven't hit the trigger. So I think that's a measurement issue. I mean, we could debate that, but I do think, you know, if we're going to go down this analysis, we do need to have that sort of situation in mind.
I'm more in the camp that the obligating event is not on day one, but on day minus one, meaning that I have to record a liability on in December year-end financial statement, as stated in paragraphs 50 to 52, because usually you would say that I want to participate in the market, and I know that by year-end. I can only avoid that by withdraw from the market, but I would know that by year-end that I want to withdraw. But if I do not want to do that, management would know that they either want to participate or do not want to. If they want to participate in the market, they know that they have to pay the levy. And if I know that I have to pay the levy, I think I have a liability. You might call that prudence, which is not a concept that is the current framework, but I think that usually you would say that I cannot avoid it unless I withdraw from a market, and I know that I want to withdraw from the market or I want to participate. I think I have the liability on day minus one. But I know that I'm not, but I'm the only not one probably.
You have it on day minus two also?
How do you square it with 36?
Well, on day minus two you won't have financial statements, will you?
Okay, day minus 90? You already know that you're going to be in business the next year. That was a difficulty with going back.
I didn't know how far to go back.
Joanna? And then I have Luca, Laurence, Charlotte, and Guido.
I disagree with you, Bent, for effectively the reasons that Scott has said there, and I think that if you follow IAS 37 and you talk about a past event, do I have a present obligation as a result of a past event? Yes, constructive obligations fit into that, but to me, as at 31st of December, you do not have a past event and you do not have a present obligation. I only have it on 1st of January. And therefore, I agree with your conclusion in paragraph 65 in terms of that. So just to offer support for that approach, then, if you like, yes, I have definitely have some empathy or sympathy or whatever with trying to accrue it. Now, whether that is you, because I think it is absolutely essential that we completely separate the measurement from the recognition. But the recognition, I really do think that following 37, we have an obligation on 1st of January. Then it's a question of what is the debit on 1st of January? Is the debit expense on 1st of January, or is the debit a prepayment, if you like? Because we do actually, despite the fact that we said we don't generally always have an asset, we may have an asset, in which case, in those circumstances, we do have an asset that we can recognise. But I don't know how we can avoid saying we have an obligation on 1st of January if that is the payment, effectively the date.
Okay. Luca, can you hit your button so I know which one to push here? There we go.
I agree with the staff conclusion. I think really that looking at IAS 36 and IFRS 6, the real issue is to understand if we have a present obligation or not. And I agree that the participation in the market is the present obligation that we have to look at. Even though I share the concern of Bernard, because in general this is an issue that you can find in many cases, not only for this kind of provision, but also for other kind of provision, in which you know exactly that it's very unreal or difficult that you will not have this kind of liability. But it's my mind is quite clear that what is written today in EIA 36 strongly supports, which is the staff conclusion that we have to look at the presence or not of the present obligation deriving from a past events. This is consistent with is the approach to recognize in the year 2011 the liabilities and not to anticipate it at the previous year.
Charlotte, I think I've got you, or Lawrence, near next. Can you push the button?
I said I wanted to come up with 2 points. I thought Scott's point was very interesting, because although I think it's a measurement thing, I think it is implicitly a condition of the obligation as well. You are required to be in operation in 2010 and 2011 in order to pay that obligation. And it was, and I think that should be explored more. With regard to the no realistic alternative, I think I have quite a lot of sympathy with Bernd's point of view that as of the end of the year, you have no way out of that obligation, and it does seem the right situation that you should be accruing it, and you should be accruing it from the stage when you have no realistic alternative. And I don't necessarily think it contradicts with 37. There are examples in 37 where the mere statement of an intention or creation of a policy manual is seen as giving you enough obligation to continue to accrue. And so I would say, I mean, if you are entering into contracts, if you are acting in a way that demonstrates to a reasonable person that you're expecting to continue in business after the year end, are you creating that reasonable expectation, and would that create an obligating event in its own way? But I think that is a different standard from no realistic alternative, and I'm not sure how to marry the two.
Right.
As much as I would really would have liked to find solutions in exploring Scott's thinking or Ben's thinking, I must admit that technically I have difficulty with them, and I do believe that the staff's demonstration in the paper is the right one, and that effectively the triggering event for the past events is participation on the date specified in the legislation. Just to add to examples to Ben's point, or Scott's point, my jurisdictions, we have plenty different types of levies. One of them is with the triggering event being on 1st January. On 1st January, for properties, you pay taxes on properties if you hold the property on 1st of January, based on the value of the property 2 years before. So...
But you didn't have to own it 2 years before.
No.
So, that...
There, I think, you only have one obligating event, owning it on the first of the year in question, because you didn't have to own it 2 years before to have to pay that tax. I think that's different. That's a situation where the 2 years before numbers are only measurement, because you will have to pay whether you owned the property or not during the measurement period. I'm getting the periods wrong. I can't remember what the calculation period, I think. In that one, you'll pay whether you owned it during the calculation period or not, whereas in the example in paragraph 46, you had to have sales in the calculation period in order to have to pay. So there I think that you have an arrangement that has multiple obligating events. In your situation, the earlier event is only measurement. It doesn't decide whether you'll have to pay. It only decides how much. But in the example here, if you weren't in business in 2010, you can sell all you want in 2011, and you won't have to pay a levy for that year. That's what bothers me about the answer, even though I think if you read 37, focusing on the paragraphs here, you can say I've got nothing. But then I go to the volume rebate situations that Andrew mentioned, and if I apply the same logic, I got nothing until you hit the threshold.
Okay, somehow in my record keeping, I have Guido written down twice, so that must mean he really wants to talk. So we'll go Guido, Jean, Philippe. And Sarah also.
Thanks, Wayne. I have to say, to come back quickly to what Scott has said, I'm also in the camp that the obligating event, even if we have multiple obligating events, the last one is then the important one. Because the question that we have to ask ourselves, if I look at my situation at a certain point in time, and that's a balance sheet date, do I have an obligation? And can I avoid making the payment? If yes, if I can avoid it, I don't have an obligation, I don't have a liability. So even if I have multiple obligating events, I would recognize it at the last one.
And I think if that's the analysis, then I have a feeling we've been doing some things wrong elsewhere.
So coming back to the example, I would also agree with the conclusion that the staff has drawn in this specific situation, because the obligating event is then probably the first revenue that you create in the year 2011. And if at that point of time, if you would set up a balance sheet and would say, well, can I avoid making this payment? And the answer is no, then you have the obligating event and you have to recognize the liability in full. And you can't spread it over the year, over the revenues that you recognize over the year. So I agree with what the staff has said in this paper.
I so I agree that I don't have an obligating event at day minus one. Otherwise, I think by analogy, I would have many obligating events the year before the events takes place. I agree that I have an obligating event on January 1st in the fact pattern that was described here. I think we should really distinguish recognition from measurement in trying to analyze the liability side of the equation. I think recognition is, for me, arise on day one when I participate, because this is the obligating event. I have to pay the levy. The measurement, there's an interesting analysis that the staff has made about the measurement, whether we can go ratably over time in building up the liability, although I must admit I have some difficulties conceptually to see why the measurement would increase ratably over time. There is the volume rebate. There's there are other situations where I believe you build the liability ratably over time. But I have some difficulties conceptually to understand how you get there. I know you've tried to make a point in your analysis that you build ratably. If we can get there, I think it solved the issue. But honestly, I believe we could to solve the issue of a one-time hit lies with the asset, on the asset side. But I think for me, I think I agree with those that says let's look at the liability first, and if we are obligated to record the liability all at once, the full liability, then I think the answer is in the asset side. And I'm not too familiar with the bank levy, but in reading this example here, I thought that I have a prepaid and I have some sort of basis for differing the expense.
Lieb?
Thank you. I'm not going to try to influence the committee. I just want to raise a question about paragraph 57. The constructive obligation and this discussion of the possibility for the entity to go out of business on day one of the following period. What always troubled me is not the concept of prudence, but a notion of consistency. Presumably, the entity will draw its financial statements as of December 31, midnight, on the basis of a going concern assumption. It will not provide for staff dismissal. It will not write off assets. So that, in a way, creates a presumption that the entity will be in business on day one next year as of 1 o'clock in the morning. And the idea that it could decide to go out of business before between midnight, last day of previous year, and 1 o'clock next year, and say, I don't have a constructive obligation because of that possibility, just I find it a bit questionable. So I would like, for the sake of completeness, if the staff could maybe, under 57, try to discuss this point, this argument about the consistency between two underlying assumptions in the financial statements.
Sir?
I want to go back to a point Scott made. I wasn't as bothered by it as Scott, because it just seemed to me that the obligating event was, am I in business on January 1st of 2011? If I am, I'm obligated to pay this levy. Fine. Well, the amount that I pay is based on activity in 2010. Well, if I'm a startup in 2011, I have no 2010, so the amount that I pay is zero, but I'm still obligated. I have the obligation of the levy. It's just the amount zero. So I kind of treated it as, if you're a startup, you got a grace period for a year. That's about how it seemed to me. Then going forward, next year in 2012, assuming you're still in business, you will pay based upon 2011 activity. So it was more just to me that prior year was just the determined the amount that you paid, but you had to be in business on January 1st to have the obligating event. So I didn't see that there were two, but I could have just looked at it fairly narrowly. In other words, how I looked at it was, being in business on January 1st was a necessary and sufficient condition to be obligated for the levy. Then we looked at how much that tax was going to be.
Joanna.
I just wanted to follow up on Leap's query around the constructive obligation, and I wonder whether we're reading too much into constructive obligation, because I think that the key is you have to have, under 37, my reading of 37 is you have to have a present obligation. That present obligation can arise through a legal or a constructive type of obligation. But the key is it has to be present as a result of a past event, and therefore the fact that you have no realistic ability to get out between 1 minute past midnight and 1 minute after midnight, I actually think is actually irrelevant for 37, and therefore I actually think we're making too much of the constructive thing. I think it's a non-issue. So that's how I read 37. The key is it's a present obligation as a result of a past event, which could have arisen through a constructive one.
I have Lawrence, Ruth, and then I'm going to try and see if anybody has any bright ideas on how we pull this together. Lawrence can hit you.
Yeah, I was having the same reaction as Joanna, saying that the obligating event, the present obligation also is on 1st of January, and I don't believe that there is a constructive obligation before. And even practically, if we were to go along that route, this would be very difficult to implement in practice. Because when would the constructive obligation arise? 31st December? 15 October? 30 September? Whatever date. And so I don't think this is a proper route to explore either.
Philippe, is this a two-hand?
Yeah.
Okay.
I'm very happy with the two answers. It's just if you keep this element of the discussion in paragraph 57, either you get out of it, or if you keep it, then expand it, because I think it's incomplete.
Ruth?
Yeah, just wanted to say I agree with what Joanna has said, because I was a bit concerned about arguing the going concern argument and the constructive obligation, because it made me think about economic compulsion. And we don't accept economic compulsion in IAS 32 as a reason for recognising a financial liability. So I don't think we can use that as an argument here either. So I don't think the constructive obligation argument holds in this case, in this example.
Thanks. I have to admit, I always kind of worry when we talk about going concern, because I've never actually understood where it leads me on anything. Sounds good, but not sure where it takes me on a lot of issues. I've written down 5 points here that seem to have gained some traction, because at the end of the day, we got to figure out what to do with this. The first is the analysis of one event versus two event. And Sarah, I think, also made the comment necessary and sufficient. So let's put those two together. If only one event is necessary and sufficient, then we don't really have a two obligating event situation. So that's one question. These are not in any necessarily perfect order. The second is the question of spreading. I think everybody is concerned by an answer that says on January 1st, your bookkeeping entry is credit liability debit expense. That is troubling for a whole bunch of different reasons. The third one I have written down is how we separate recognition from measurement. I suspect, Scott, at least as we've talked about it in the board, a lot of that goes away if you're real careful about what you define what the liability is. If you call your royalty thing of the liability being the contract, then you're always estimating, I think, as Andrew said, cash flows under the contract. And then the last one I have written down that seems to have gotten some traction, notwithstanding Andrew's concerns early on, this notion of there's something different about, and maybe the idea of a fee for participation in a market is the wrong way to describe it, but it seems like there's something different between a license and a fine. And I suppose if you held my feet to the fire, I might find it difficult to be real articulate sometimes about distinguishing the two. But I seem to have heard among the group there the idea that there's some traction around the idea that this is comparable to a license or a toll, or a fee for participation is another way to describe it, that distinguishes it from just the government has decided to stick it to this community, to use the vernacular. So that seems to be distinguishing. So having said all that, what I'd like to now ask people is thoughts on how we actually turn this into a work product. Because what we've had is kind of a general discussion of IAS 37, which the board has had so much luck dealing with. How do we first scope and then focus this into a work product that'll be useful for somebody? So that's the question I'd like to put to the House now, is scope and structure, for lack of a better word. Scott, you're up.
Because I was having the concern that I expressed earlier as I was going through this, I started thinking about scope as is my problem that The situations that concern me are contractual arrangements in general. As you said, we have a volume rebate arrangement. We have a royalty arrangement. These are contractual. The situations that this paper is addressing are not contractual. They are government imposed. If the scope is limited to government imposed obligations, then I can push some of my concerns about the single versus multiple obligating event aside. And if we agree that we're not trying to address contractual situations, we're only trying to address here government fees and what have you, that feels a lot better to me. I can follow the analysis, and it doesn't cause me a whole lot of problems in other areas. With respect to the license versus fine discussion, not that this is always clear, but it seems to me that a license fee is something you pay for operating the way you're supposed to operate. A fine is something you pay for operating in a way you weren't supposed to operate. And so certainly a fine feels to me like something you would have to book immediately as an expense when you do the thing you weren't supposed to do, whereas I can see more arguments for recognizing a license as some form of prepaid or intangible asset.
Okay. Lawrence, Ruth, Joanna.
I support the directions you are going, Wayne. With respect to the scope, I agree that we are not dealing with contracts over here. So it's special kind of transaction that has not yet been addressed in the RESB's literature. This morning's discussion has shown that if we go the theoretical way, analyzing whether you have liability, an asset, and so on, it's going to be very difficult to get there and to get to an agreement, to get to the outcome, to an outcome that would make sense. So with respect to your second question about how do we get there, what can we do in order to help, I believe that, well, I don't know whether this would be within the remit of the Interpretation Committee to deal with, but I'm more and more thinking that perhaps this should be a separate project of the IASB to deal with this specific kind of transactions.
Okay. I think I have Ruth up next.
I think first of all, I agree that if we could limit it to government-imposed obligations, that would be helpful. In terms of creating the distinction between a license and a fine, I'm not sure that will be helpful because I think there's something in the middle, which is a levy. And, for example, I've just been imposed as an Australian taxpayer a flood levy that I have to pay because of the floods. Now, I didn't do anything to cause the floods, and the government's not going to give me anything back at all as a result of my paying the levy. I don't benefit other than I have to pay some more tax. So that's a levy, and it's called a flood levy. So I think in the banking case, the banking levy fits more into that sort of situation where the government says, we need to raise some more funds, we're in dire straits, our banks need to contribute some more money because of the economic crisis, et cetera, et cetera. So they impose a levy. I don't think it's a license. I don't think it necessarily gives the bank a right to do anything or to benefit from anything. It's just an imposition by the government that says we need to raise cash and here's how we're going to do it. I don't think it's a fine because the bank hasn't necessarily done anything wrong. I didn't do anything wrong to have to pay the flood levy. I have to pay it. So I think it's something that fits in between. And I'm still struggling to see the asset there. But I would support narrowing the scope to a government-imposed obligation. I think if we look back to the original submission from memory, it was the UK banking levy that we were asked about. And I think if we were to solve anything, that should be the one we should solve, because that's the one we were asked to solve. I think we went broad because we said there are other things that we need to look at and take into account, but we were asked to address a specific situation.
Joanna?
I guess of a similar view, I wonder in terms of thinking, how can we be helpful and how can we do something to get something out there? I believe that it would be useful to effectively have a scope of something that is in relation to a government-imposed amount of money that needs to be paid. And the first thing that we should then do is to say, well, yes, they could range from what we talked about in terms of effectively a license fee to a levy in the middle to a fine. But the key is then saying, and look at 37, and these are, because I actually think that we have probably all broadly agreed as to how you look at it in 37. So we could give some useful guidance for those to say, in order to recognise the liability, and that's what you've got to think about first, 37 is where to go to, and these are some clues to help you to determine when you recognise it, and the key is recognition and not measurement, etc., etc. Then the question is, what do you do with the debit? And I personally think that that would be very useful if we could give some guidance there, but I think that I would say, staff, please can we do a little bit more work before we actually go there? But I think that that is the set. So effectively to do some two-step guidance or interpretation, if you like, of the first being when you recognise the obligation for this broad array of things, and then the second being what do you do with the debit, and I think that that is where you may end up with different answers depending on what this thing you've got to pay to the government actually is.
I suspect so. Margaret, I think you're up next.
Whether it's a fine or a license or some kind of a fee, I think if it's a one-time payment versus something that's going to be an annuity, perhaps, say, every 3 years or every year, every 2 years or so or every year, I think that makes a difference, too, because I could see making more of an argument if something is going to have some kind of a recurring nature versus just a one-off transaction.
Guido, I think you're up next, and then Andrew.
Thanks, Wayne. I'm fully in Joanna's camp. I think it makes sense to look at it in two steps. I think we got pretty far on the liability side already, and there is some diversity in practice when to recognize it over a period or not. So we could give guidance there within the scope of government-imposed payments. Whether we can give an answer to the debit side, it's worthwhile to look at it. Is it a fine or a license? I think we come back then to what the staff has thought about. If it's a license, then we probably have an executive contract because the government is giving something to you in exchange for your money, directly to you. And I think that's the difference between – in Germany, we have a – differentiate between taxes, so I pay something – but I don't get anything directly back. So this flood levy would be a tax under this definition. Levies would be something I pay something to the government or to the city, let's say to the city, and they have the obligation to supply me with water. I mean, that's a levy. That's something where I directly get something back for my money. So whether we can come up with a conclusion on the second question, I don't know. It's worthwhile thinking about it, but I
we could get some clues.
Right. So I think we should pick it up, and I think this makes sense. For me, it's an interpretation that we should do.
Andrew?
Well, just an observation on what Scott and Ruth said. I mean, I agree. I don't think fine is the right parameter at this end of the scale. I think it's more like a tax. It's just not an income tax. If it was an income tax, we might be, know what to do with it. But I think.
Well, we'd know where to look. But still, we'd know what to do.
I think looking at it, a fine. I think the accounting for that would be quite relatively straightforward. But it's essentially a number of them, at least, are in the nature of a tax.
Sarah, I think you're up next.
I agree with what Andrew said, but I want to carry it a step further. I do look at this as a tax, albeit not an income tax, more like a surtax or an excise tax. So it may be helpful to explore that venue in terms of helping to analyze what we do with the debit. In other words, we've talked about we think we can be helpful in when to recognize and when the obligating event, what the obligating event is and when to recognize, then what to do with the debit. If we maybe think of this as, because we said it's not exactly a license and it's not a fine, but it is a form of tax, and it may be a form of surtax or excise tax, and that may help us decide what to do with the debit. That might be helpful.
Yeah, I was also having this, when Ruth says it's a levy, it's actually probably the closest picture of what it is. I wonder if nobody has talked about IS-12 as being maybe we should look at IS-12 and see whether we could find some help there, although I understand it doesn't fit the criteria to fall into IS-12, but IS-12 is an example where if I participate in a market, I have to pay a levy. The levy is the income tax. How I measure is through my profit. But even if I go out of the market in February, I still have at the end of the year to pay based on the profit I've made up to February. So maybe my obligating event in terms of income taxes is to be there on the 1st of January, which would seem to have some analogy to what we're looking here. And the model of IS-12 is that you build over time. You know, you build a liability as you not based on your best estimate of what will be your profit at the year end, but as you progress. So it's a progressive, I don't know if it's recognition measurement, but I'd say progressive measurement of the liability, that is where you have an obligating event at the beginning of the year. So all of that to say that maybe we should look at IS-12 as being the closest analogy to what we have here, and maybe we find some solutions there, still understanding that IS-12 is a special treatment for income taxes.
I wonder, though, if I was in 12, it would be because the act of earning income created the obligation. And so there's no question. If I went out of business on July the 13th, I would owe tax for any taxable income that I created up to that point. I can't see a situation in which an income tax would also apply if I was in business the following January. And so I understand you saying maybe 12 is useful, but in some of the situations, especially that Scott was talking about, I wonder if it really buys us anything. Staff ought to take a look at it, but just an observation. Sarah, did you still want to come in, or did we just not turn off your light?
We just didn't turn off my light.
Okay. Then Scott, and then I'm going to ask the staff if they have sufficient guidance.
Just in terms of other taxes to think about, I always try to avoid looking at IAS 12 if I don't have to. I mean, we might think about how property taxes are generally treated, because I think there's some similarity there. The property tax is, you know, paid by whoever owns the property on the particular date, and it's usually paid annually. I suspect that it is not often recorded entirely as an expense just on the particular date. I'm not.
It's going to open Pandora's box.
I'm not sure what. I'm not sure what IFRS actually says to do with property taxes, but we might at least think about it as we're thinking about these fees or levies or taxes or whatever we decide to call them.
Okay. I'm getting the impression that we may have beaten this horse as far much as we can for this meeting. I heard a scope limitation, so we're going to scope out. The proposal was that we scope out private contracts and focus strictly on the range of things that government can assess. I suspect that at some point we might also scope out things that are fines or that sort of thing, because Scott's right, those, I think the accounting is pretty straightforward. And then I heard a proposal that we try and distinguish between levies, as in stuff for which there probably isn't any commensurate return, like a flood levy, or frequently many other taxes, and things that for which there is an exchange transaction, and separate those two groups.
Only for the asset side or the debit side?
No, I think you might think differently about the credit side, too, if there was an exchange transaction as to what the obligation date was. I don't know. Maybe not, but it seems like my view would be the staff ought to think about it. Guys, anything else that you would interject?
I'd just say the original submission contained a general question along with four examples of specific taxes. The UK banking levy, which mentioned today, was one of those four. I think we should be focusing on the general question rather than a jurisdictional specific levy, because I think the result of that would then be more helpful to more people around the world. Just wanted to get your sense on that as well. Okay.
I see general agreement.
But noting the urgency for the banking levy, because they will have to book for it at year end and they don't know how to book it.
Okay, noted. The one other thing that I wanted to check with you on was the question that Philippe had raised regarding going concern and no realistic alternative and the interplay between those two. Now, that is something that is often stated or specified in arguments for and against recognising these liabilities. It didn't seem as if this was necessarily core to this issue, but I did want to ask whether you thought we should additionally explore that line of argument as well or not.
I would argue the only reason we should explore it would be to kill it, if you see what I mean. I.e. not ignore it, but make sure people understand that it is not appropriate.
And that would be, I think, a good basis or reason for exploring it, if the committee's in agreement.
I don't see any objections.
Okay.
Any other comments on this one, or are we ready to move on to something else? Other than Ruth wants us to turn the thermostat up. Ah, okay. That too. Why don't we take 15 minutes? Come back at 20 up. Yeah, you have to go down.